Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Women to Watch is an intimate look into the lives of prominent and influential women leaders from around the world and the challenges they faced on their journey. It's the real story behind her title. Join us every week to hear more stories about women from around the world and in your own communities at womentowatch.net. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another week of Women to Watch, a podcast of inspiring stories from women leaders shaping our world today. I'm Sue Rocco. Joining me in just a moment will be Erin Lydon. And Erin is the former president of Poker Power. She's also a strategic advisor for executives in gaming, edtech, and finance. If you're a small business owner and you're looking for some guidance for yourself, she's going to be bringing some great information and tips on how to do that and stay afloat in this economy. As always, stay with us during the breaks where you'll hear from our exclusive watch team of corporate partners, bringing you news and information from their industries. And I always invite you to subscribe to our YouTube channel at W2W Media. So now I'm very honored to welcome to the show, Erin Lydon. Erin, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Susan. Delighted to be here.
It's wonderful to have you. When I was looking over my notes and thinking about your life story and your career, I'm excited to kind of dig in and find out how a little girl from New England grew up to be a strategic advisor for executives in technology and gaming and finance. It's been quite a journey and an eclectic one. But we always start at the beginning. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about your upbringing in New England. I know that you were born in Maine. I know that, you know, you were raised by parents and even grandparents who were very involved in your success. So talk a little bit about that and how you think it has affected who you are today.
Absolutely. I am born and bred in Maine and very proud of it. And multi-generations are Mainers. And I would say I had, you know, one of those very bucolic, lovely New England childhoods. You know, I always say now that it was pre-everything that was really, you know, has changed the way children are raised today. And I'm very grateful for that. You know, I spent my summers on a bicycle all over town. It was a small town I lived in and lots of friends, a very safe childhood. But it, you know, no childhood is perfect.
And that's mine, right.
Mine certainly was one where achievement was very highly valued, all the way from my granddad down to my mom. We were very achievement oriented in my family, to the point that, you know, I've often said, I was always asked, you know, what did I do? What did I achieve? And I really wasn't asked, how do I feel? And when you spend your entire childhood and into, you know, your college and young 20s, not really talking about feelings. That's very stereotypical New England, or it used to be. But it there's something missing when you're raised that way. And I am very proud of all the things that I have accomplished, you know, both personally and professionally. But I've worked very, very hard to be a more compassionate and empathetic. And it is work. It is not a natural tendency of mine. And I think as being a leader, I've really had to develop that skill.
Yeah. And you shared with me, you know, just to give our viewers a sense of what that looked like for you, that you took some etiquette classes from your grandmother. Yes. And you had to call her and share your report card scores.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, that seems like a lot of pressure.
My older sister and I, from as long as I can remember, had to call my grandparents on the phone when we got our report cards every quarter and read aloud the grades. And we were never paid for grades. I think that's something that came later in life for, you know, some high achieving children. Our reward was our granddad saying, you know, good job. And he really did mean it. He was very proud of us. But he himself was very achievement oriented and expected that from, he actually had many, many granddaughters before he ended up with a grandson. So all the granddaughters were raised similarly to that. And the etiquette, I'm so glad that happened. It sounds so old fashioned now. But when I was 10 or 11, past 12, I spent a week living at my grandparents, and they were part of the country club set. So they had lots of social events at their home. And my grandmother taught me everything, how to polish silverware. She'd pay me a penny a piece for silver, how to pass, you know, a plate of hors d'oeuvres, and certainly how to greet people. And I've actually carried that on with my own two daughters who are now in college. From a very young age, I taught them to shake hands and make eye contact. So yes. It was natural. It's a really critical skill to have. It was a little strange. I agree.
Well, I think probably as a young girl, you know, you're wanting to please, right? And so there's that expectation of, I can't make a mistake. I can't fail, right? And that opens doors for, you know, that those feelings of anxiety, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, very much.
Yeah, as a mother yourself, you mentioned your two daughters. Tell me how you're trying to do things differently as a parent, keeping the good things that shaped you, but trying to be a little bit more open to them and what their dreams might be.
Yeah, and it's a work in progress. They would both say that. I'm sure they will listen to this or watch this and want to hear what I have to say about them. I'm tremendously proud. They're my greatest gift and my greatest, you know, piece of work that's ever been produced is those two girls. But they are different than me. And it's funny. I'm a runner. I've always been a runner. And so I push both of the girls directly into running because that's what I know and that's something I enjoy. The older one is a natural runner, the younger one not so much, but she really didn't get choice in a lot of the early decisions of her childhood. And I reflect back on that and you know, I probably could have made more space to get to know her as an individual, as crazy as that may sound as a parent, but to really allow her true self to come out. She, now that she's in college, you know, has very much, you know, flown her wings and you know, she's ready to go and being the person that she wants to be. But for me, I had to let go of some of what is both comfortable and the expectations that I have. You know, I have very high academic expectations, very high, you know, moral and value expectations for my daughters. But I needed to create space for them to turn into the people that they really are meant to be. And it's not every day that I'm good at that. You know, I still kind of default to, you know, what did you get on that test?
Erin, I wanted to talk to you about your decision to go to Bates College. And, you know, how you came upon your decision to study English and French.
Yeah. So I come from a family that has many, many generations have gone to Bates. Our first graduate was a woman. I'm very proud of that. In 1919, grandfather, uncle, aunts, lots and lots of us. I was valedictorian in high school. So you would imagine I probably had a lot of options on where I could apply and certainly decide to attend. And I actually went early decision at Bates. I felt so strongly about the family school. And I can't lie. I really wanted to please my granddad. I'm going to throw my sister and cousin under the bus, but they're older. And one went to Brown and one went to Bowdoin. And my granddad was really disappointed that the Bates tradition wasn't coming in this generation. And that was a factor in why I decided to go there. It was a fantastic decision. I loved the school. I was familiar with the school. And I was a writer. You know, I loved to read and I was a writer. And so studying English literature was very
natural to me. My grandmother was a Francophone. She actually has French blood. And so she was very excited that I was also studying French. I actually studied in Cameroon, Africa for my junior year, of all crazy places. Right. You know, when your parents would send you to Paris and you choose to go to West Africa, you're unusual in lots of ways.
There may have been some questions about that.
There definitely were some concerns about that. But I grew up. And actually from that experience, my senior thesis at Bates was writing a novel. And so I wrote a novel, which was partly autobiographical of that experience in Cameroon. So I came out of Bates and I went into publishing. That was my dream job. You know, it didn't last. I didn't know that when you're at the bottom of the totem pole in the publishing world, what you're doing is you're taking a red pen and you're correcting manuscripts all day long. You're not writing anything. You're not talking to the authors. And I was disillusioned really quickly. And that really put into motion, you know, some pivots that I made pretty shortly after that.
Yeah. Can we go back for a second to your internship in Cameroon? That is something adventurous. As you said, you could have gone to Paris.
Yeah.
Tell me, what was your fondest memory of that time there? And what do you think it taught you about just people and culture?
Absolutely. I grew up very sheltered. I didn't know it at the time, of course, but you know, I traveled certainly with my family, but I didn't have a lot of diverse experiences growing up in a little town in Maine. I find myself living in a very large city, Yaoundé, in Cameroon, living with a homestay family. And then later in the program, we all had to do a 1 month long homestay by ourselves. And so it was really a pre-Peace Corps type of program, an immersion program. And I had some really hard days. So, you know, when you first talked to me about Cameroon, I tend to default to really how tough it was, how lonely it was, how scared I was. I struggled with the language. The patois that is spoken in Cameroon is different than the French that I had learned in school. But with all this time to reflect on it, there's no way I would be the person I am today, because from that experience, I was able to move to Chicago, you know, the day after I graduated college. I was a Maine girl. You know, that was a pretty big leap for me to do that. Mm-hmm. From there, I've done so many things that are outside of my comfort zone over the last, you know, 20 years, 30 years. And I really credit that growing up time that I had in Cameroon and the struggle that I went through ended up being this enormous positive impact on my life.
I would imagine that just making the decision to go there and do it and come home and have had the experience gives you a boost of confidence. What can I try next?
Yeah, it was that. And also, you know, I had actually planned to go to Morocco. That was so I still wanted to be in Africa, but I really wanted to be in North Africa, in Morocco. And this is the early 90s, and it's 1991, actually, and the Gulf War had broken out. And so my Morocco program was canceled with very little notice. And the only openings in the program were Cameroon. And I'm embarrassed to say, but I'll be honest, I had to look on the map because I wasn't exactly sure where Cameroon was, or Guadeloupe. I remember my dad so clearly saying, well, Aaron, you're not going to the Caribbean, so you're still going to Africa. You're just going a little further south, which I did. And so I think the maturity that I had from living on my own there and having to figure out transportation and language and culture and go to school every day, I so strongly encourage young people at some point in the trajectory of, you know, between high school and post-college, to force themselves into that type of experience.
Yeah. Something else you shared with me, because we talk about what we perceive as failure for ourselves, and you and I were talking about that, and you brought up a project you worked on, fisherman project. Tell me a little bit again about what happened with that project, and why do you think that you felt as though it didn't end up the way you perceived?
Yeah. So as part of this program, as I mentioned, there were 12 students who were with me on the program, and we each had to spend a month living separately, away from the group, away from the teachers, and outside of the big city we were in. And so I was in a little town called Creeby. It was a beach town, and those who know me know I love the beach, I love the water, and so that's why I chose to go there. But you had to develop a research project during that 1 month time frame. So I worked very closely with a government official to work on this very interesting economics project, where the Cameroonian government was trying to encourage the fishermen in this village and really along the coastline to catch more fish. And the reason for that is the entire interior of the country at the time was really protein deficient. And they had the great ideas, we catch more fish in our ocean, we ship it inland, we're going to have a healthier population throughout the country. So logical, made sense to me. I sign up for this. I show up in this little village. I'm supposed to be met by a Peace Corps volunteer, and she was literally medevaced the day before with filaria, which is some terrible eye disease bug thing. Yeah. So she's not even there to greet me. So I walk into this town, literally get off the bus, walk into the town, and no one knows who I am. But I am certainly the only white college girl in that entire town. So they notice me without a doubt.
And probably a little worried that you yourself might get sick.
Yeah. There were so many things.
That's what I would have been worried about. Oh my gosh.
And so I start this project with the fishermen. And what was so fascinating to me is that really no one in the government had had the conversation with the people that they were actually asking to catch more fish. And the difficulty was is that the government was going to provide them with a very cheaply financed engine for their little pirogue, for their canoes, so they could go further offshore because the shoreline's very overfished. The issue was, is that these are subsistence fishermen. So they only want to catch, they only want to be out on the water long enough to catch what they need for that day or the next and to take to the market if they're selling a little bit of it. But it really wasn't a sustainable business that they thought about scaling. Like, this is not how they were thinking at all. And so they didn't even want to spend, for some reason, the number $40 sticks in my head is what the cost of those engines would have been. Secondly, the majority of them didn't know how to swim. And you're not going to find a lot of life jackets when you're walking through a little village in Cameroon. And so they were scared. I mean, they just truly were scared to go that far offshore. And there didn't seem to be really any economic need for them personally to do that. Having not been able to figure this out in advance was
deep. That's a big challenge, by the way. Yeah, that's a big challenge that they're not motivated by income and they're also afraid.
And they're also afraid. And so I actually ended up spending more time with the fisherwomen because I felt really safe with them and I found them fascinating, you know, how hard they were working, you know, in the market each day and just learning sort of more about the economics of the local market than around the fishermen. But my project and my assignment and the paper I needed to write was all about these fishermen. And I felt, even though I really wasn't the lever that got pulled in any of this, I felt like I had failed because I was in this village for a month. I didn't really have a lot to show for it. The program was definitely not successful. And I wasn't used to taking on things and not getting the A+. You know, I really was used to just getting the A+ on something. I could somehow control it. I could, you know, find a way to make that happen. And I couldn't with this situation.
What do you think you learned? Because we all know that when things don't go right, there's always a lesson. There's always something that you learned from that experience that was worthwhile.
Yeah. Well, I think I've taken a lot of those lessons, mainly that I needed to be more culturally aware than I was. I certainly didn't understand the environment that I was walking into and being expected to succeed in. I also think, and I have to remember, we didn't have cell phones, so there really was no way to communicate back to the official who was in the capital city, but I should have reset. I should have hit pause, and then I should have reset and probably figured out a different way to feel successful in this project. And I just kind of went down the rabbit hole of, this isn't working, I'm wasting my time.
And you were young.
And I was very shy. You know, I'm already introverted in many ways. And I was, you know, not speaking the language very well. You know, there were a lot of hurdles that I was trying to overcome. I come away from all of that. And I'm like, well, I actually learned a lot. The fact that I'm talking about it 30 years later, I probably learned something from this experience.
That's right.
It shaped how I handle, you know, adversity and how I am resilient, because I would definitely use the word resilient when it comes to my entire life. Part of that came from that experience.
Yeah. Listen, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to really talk about the pivot from publishing to Wall Street.
Yeah.
How that opportunity came to be. Stay with us as we go into our break, where you'll hear from our watch team of corporate partners, and we'll be back with Aaron Lydon.
American investment. More jobs, higher wages. It's why Congress passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act in 2017 and American businesses delivered. Investing in U.S. manufacturing, increasing wages for American workers, and creating over 500,000 new jobs. Unless Congress acts, tax hikes on American families, workers, and businesses will set us back. Tell Congress to extend and strengthen tax reform. Paid for by Business Roundtable.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
As a female-led organization, you have to bring it every single day. We're a mashup of sort of right and left brain. So we're not just doing management consulting. We're not just doing creative services. We're not just producing an event, but we're bringing a comprehensive solution to our clients. And because of the way we approach it, we end up being bought into what it is that we're doing in a way that we truly have as much skin in the game as our clients do, whether it's bringing affordable internet to communities across the Caribbean, or it's helping Comcast with their Internet Essentials program, which is something we've been very proud to work on, or it's helping the NFL celebrate their centennial season by getting 1 million people to give at least 100 minutes to causes they care about, or helping the city of Philadelphia win the World Cup. So what's next for us? Well, we just hit just over 100 employees. I think we are at that tipping point, and I don't think there's anybody that does it better than we do. I'm Maggie Wilkinson, CEO of Athena Global Advisors, a company that is proudly based in Philadelphia.
Hi, I'm Katie Gore, the president of Quidel Consulting and Training. There are a lot of myths about affordable housing and the people who need and live in affordable housing. One myth, for example, only people who are unemployed need and live in affordable housing. The reality is that many people in affordable housing actually have working full-time jobs. Teachers, healthcare workers, service employees, people who are essential in our communities. They often struggle to afford rent in so many communities across the nation. And that's what's the beauty about affordable housing. They are providing work in the communities at an affordable rent. Another myth is that affordable housing increases crime. Studies consistently show there is no link between affordable housing and increased crime. In fact, stable housing can reduce crime by providing security and fostering stronger community neighborhoods and building attachment for the people who live in affordable housing. For more information about affordable housing and to walk through some more of those myths, you can find me and my segment on the Women to Watch platform.
Welcome back to the show. I'm speaking this week with Erin Leiden. And Erin is the former president of Poker Power, and she's also a current business advisor for Cultivate Advisors. And just before the break, I was mentioning, you know, you made a pivot, obviously, from publishing and writing into Wall Street and finance. How did that opportunity come to be?
Yeah. So it came to be from a way that has really created a lot of great things in my life, is I say yes to things I don't know how to do, and then I figure it out. And so I was actually asked to babysit when I was 23 years old, which I was really not very, very fond of doing at that age, but something told me to say yes to this opportunity. And it turned out that the mother of the family I babysat for one evening was one of the most well-connected women in Chicago. I'd graduated, I'd left Maine, I'd moved to Chicago. And she took me under her wing. I mean, I really to this day think of her as my Chicago mom because she has had such an incredible influence on my life. But she brought me into Northwestern Memorial Hospital as a fundraiser, and particularly for the organization, which was the Lynn Sage Foundation, that she was the chairwoman of.
And I was her right hand in every possible way. I was her right hand.
Were you doing that on the side of a job, a full-time job?
No, I had left publishing. And so this was okay. My job. So I was a full-time fundraiser. And within a couple of years, I had been promoted to overseeing 27 fundraising organizations at Northwestern. So we had a very active philanthropic program with different donors. It turns out that most of these donors were also movers and shakers in Chicago. So by the time I was 25, this is an old-fashioned word, but I had a Rolodex of basically every CEO in the city, and they would take my call because everyone wants to be connected to Northwestern. You care about your healthcare, you care about your doctors. And I got to be around and supporting these really incredible people in Chicago. Fast forward just another year, and Joan, my mentor, my Chicago mom, said, you know, Erin, you need to do more. And I think the more is you need to go to business school. And I said, okay, I don't really know what that means, but okay, that sounds good. And because I lived in Chicago and I didn't really want to move, I only applied to Kellogg. So I applied to one business school. I was accepted. I had applied to healthcare management because in my mind, you know, I loved healthcare. I loved being in the hospital. And I would go back to Northwestern after I'd graduated from Kellogg. As it turns out, I found out that when you go to business school, most people aren't going into healthcare management at that time. This is, you know, the late 90s. People are going into something called investment banking and consulting and actually private equity and all these really fascinating fields to me. And while I literally had not had a math class since I think I was, you know, 17, 18 years old, I pivoted into finance. And that's probably one of the biggest leaps I've ever made in my life is to just convince myself that I can get a finance degree at this, you know, top-notch school. And not only that, I can then parlay that into, you know, 8 banking offers for full time once I graduated.
What was it that you enjoyed about it? What was it that you liked?
Yeah, well, I'll be really candid. I really liked the people at Kellogg that were studying finance. I found the way that they approached the world and how their minds worked and how much they knew about business. And my dad was a CFO, so money was a very comfortable topic in our family. It wasn't hidden. I knew what my dad made for his salary. I knew he was invested in the stock market, similarly with my granddad. So it was familiar enough to me that I was also facile with numbers. And so that part of it didn't scare me. I just didn't really know what the opportunities were. And I want to caveat by saying opportunities for women with finance degrees in 1999 were the whole world. Like you were in such high demand if you had that on your resume. And that's the direction I went. I went to Wall Street.
One of the things that you've been very active in and speaking out about is equal pay.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing you discovered the inequities, you know, with your time on Wall Street. JP Morgan, right?
Mm-hmm. I was where at Morgan.
So tell me how you discovered that.
Well, so after your first year as a new associate, you go through a bonus period, and everyone at the bank, you know, goes through a similar bonus period where your boss brings you into their office and tells you all the great things you've done, the things you need to work on, and then they give you your number. And for me, the number I was given was absolutely astronomical, like multiples of salaries I had received. And I was just like starry-eyed. I couldn't believe it. And I remember so well because the boss is still a good friend of mine. And I remember shaking Fabrice's hand and saying, thank you very much. I'm so happy to be here, and walking out. Now, what happened next was a big surprise to me. Everyone else paraded through the office, you know, shook the hand, got their number, and then negotiated it. And I didn't know that I should have asked for more. It wasn't even in my purview of a possibility that I ever would have asked for more in that moment. But everybody else seemed to know that that's how the game was played. And so rather than being upset with everybody else, and I definitely wasn't even upset with my boss, I was upset with myself that I hadn't figured out how to play this game. And it felt like a huge stab in the gut of, you're so smart, you're so capable, and you just left so much money on the table. How could you have done that?
But no one told you, I don't know how you would have known that or attempted to do that, not knowing.
You have to remember, most of my colleagues were men. And I think men certainly grow up from the time they're on the playground, figuring out how to negotiate, being very comfortable talking about numbers and talking about their worth. Women, on the other hand, were often told, you know, just be polite, be nice, play with everyone so nicely, and don't ask for more. And that was how I was raised, certainly. You know, I was not an assertive child. I was not assertive in high school. And so it wasn't something I even had as a possibility that I should ask for more. What came from that is two things. One is I did a TEDx about it. So I got a lot of publicity from that. So that was great. And got to spread the word, which was the most important thing, is I could actually teach young women to ask for more. But secondly, I always ask for more now. In every part of my life, you know, personal, professional, I'm going to ask for more. And if it can be negotiated, I want to try to extract the value that I can. So it was incredibly painful in the moment. It was life-changing long-term for me that happened.
How does an introvert end up on a TED Talk stage?
All right. So here's the thing is I am very introverted socially, like in a social setting. It takes a lot of effort for me to put myself out there and be comfortable. When I am in a professional setting, when I have a mic in my hand, when I'm standing on a stage, and I've stood on so many stages at this point, I'm an entirely different person and I'm very comfortable and I just can carry off a speech and do what I need to do. So I really have two parts to my personality. But I'm very happy just, you know, being very quiet.
It's just an interesting fact to me. I think there's a lot of people like you mm-hmm. that, again, socially just are a little more private, perhaps, you know, a little more quiet, but then they can be on a big global stage and be very comfortable.
Yeah. Well, and I will tell you that for that TEDx, I mentioned I was a runner. I ran and said out loud my 18-minute speech. I know it was more than 100 runs that I practiced that speech because I wanted it to be absolutely crisp. I didn't want any notes and I wanted to own that stage. And for me, repetition and practice is how I've gotten good at everything that I do. And so it was an enormous effort to pull that off, both, you know, for me to stand there and do it, but also to just carry myself.
Did that inspire you to do more speaking? Was that kind of your first?
Yeah. I had done some, but nothing at that scale. And I got a rush, you know, and I'm a words of affirmation kind of person. And so, you know, you get off a stage and people are congratulating you. It does. You get that, you know, little hit of adrenaline and you're like, wow, okay, I can do that again. Now I, you know, give me the mic and I'm very comfortable.
Well, you have the knowledge. I would say you're so very, you're an expert at what you're teaching mm-hmm. and what you're doing. So I think that gives you a confidence level to speak, knowing that you have the information. But let's talk about Poker Power because I think a lot of people have never heard of it. Yeah. They don't know what it is. And it's such an interesting, I don't know whether to call it a program or what the proper word would be, but to help people with life skills, particularly women.
Exactly.
And it started with your daughter when she was young.
Not with my daughter, with Jenny Just's daughter, Juliet.
Jenny's daughter.
Yeah, okay. Jenny's daughter.
And
the original idea was to teach young women, you know, primarily high school aged, how to play poker. And this is pre-pandemic, so this is 2019. And Jenny and I are good friends. And she shared the idea with me one time. I was standing in her kitchen and she says, we're going to teach, you know, young girls how to play poker. And I said, well, that's a really stupid idea because women don't play poker. That's the one thing I knew from Wall Street is women do not show up for poker.
They're not allowed. They're not allowed in.
They are not welcome at that table. And she laughed and she said, no, I think it's a really good idea. Just think about it. And Jenny has had many, many good ideas. And so I did think about it. But I took a little bit of time because I personally had never played a hand of poker, didn't know the first thing about the game. In late February of 2020, I went back to her. And I said, okay, I'm willing to work on this. Let's see what we can make happen. And 3 weeks later, the world locked down. Now, that seems, you know, you and I being across the screen today doing this seems so normal to us now. But when you go back in time to March, April, May of 2020, this interaction on a digital screen was so incredibly awkward and uncomfortable to the point that the young women we were teaching were not going to turn on their Zoom for one more hour of anything because they already had to do it all day long for school. And so we had the really what I would say is a brilliant idea is that we pivoted to corporate. And at that time, every company was desperately trying to get us to turn on the camera and laugh across the screen and have some sort of interaction that felt a little bit normal during COVID. Poker Power, and I think of it as a perfect storm. Poker Power was able to just slide right in there. We very quickly built an online curriculum, a teaching curriculum. We targeted first finance institutions and then law firms and tech firms, and they had budget. They had a lot of L&D budget that they needed to spend. We all had a lot of time that we were trying to fill because we couldn't go to a restaurant and we couldn't socialize with our friends. And Poker Power was able to marry the opportunity of learn to think and strategize and negotiate like a winning poker player. It never had anything to do with getting anyone into the casino. It was all about helping you think differently. And we could do that first with a poker app. And then, of course, as the world opened up, we expanded further and we really had a very strong B2B business where in person we were, again, teaching women how to play poker.
How did you market it? You know, did people, you know, very quickly understand what learning the game of poker would do for them in their workday?
Not at all. And I think, you know, women have stereotypes. Well, anybody has a stereotype of poker, and particularly if you haven't been around the game. But for women, it's typically happening in two places. It's very James Bond, and it's, you know, in Monte Carlo at a beautiful, opulent casino. And most women don't see themselves fitting there. Or the opposite is it's down in your basement and it's a bunch of smelly guys and they're drinking and smoking and the cards are going and women don't feel welcome in that space either. And that pretty much is the stereotype that most of us have of this game. And it's not something we really would want to spend our precious time learning how to play, because the sort of the narrative of poker is really good for problem solving and negotiating and getting comfortable with imperfect information and taking risk. Like all of those things happen while you're playing this game. And in fact, if you practice and you play this game over and over and see hundreds and then thousands of hands, you are going to change how your leadership style is, how you are able to show up in, you know, difficult situations. That is the positive that I have been able to take from poker. And I now play, I still play a lot of poker. I love
you still
poker.
Play?
I love poker. Yeah. I actually play. There's a very local casino. And I spent most of last summer in one of those seats playing with mostly men in their 70s and 80s. They couldn't figure out what I was doing there or why I already knew how to play pretty well. And I would go every day. And it was a $25 buy-in, which means you had to spend $25 in order to get your chip. So you're not going to lose a ton of money at this. And I would play poker and I would make the final table. And I would be sitting there with seven or eight other men playing this game that I feel has been a tremendously positive impact in my later, you know, professional life. I came to this game, you know, quite old.
Yeah. Do you think it helps your brain? You know, we're all looking for ways to keep our brains mm-hmm. stimulated. There's the New York Times Wordle that people play every day. There's all kinds of little, yeah, I would imagine it is good for.
I think, you know, I know one of the studies with dementia is that, you know, how social you are, your friend network is actually a really, you know, contributor to whether you're going to develop dementia later in life. And having a very strong social setting is really critical. The poker table is that. And for me now, this little, you know, local casino I go to is very much that. I know everyone by name. They know me by name. You know, they're happy to see me when I sit down and you get caught up on your kids and all those kinds of things. I think the second thing is that the game is ever changing because you aren't playing the dealer and you aren't playing just a single player. Most of the time you're playing 7, 8, 9, 10 people. And humans are erratic. And the way that we play this game is unpredictable. So you could be bluffing. You could be, you know, betting for value, meaning you have a really strong hand. And so with every hand, you're having to do analysis very, very quickly, like on the spot, to figure out, should I raise? Should I fold? You know, more chips in the pot. Do I get out of this hand, save my chips for the next opportunity? That's business. That's trying to figure out, like, is this a good investment? Should I hire this employee? What are the pros? What are the cons? And doing it in this quick of time.
Quickly.
Right. Really. And with the pressure of, you know, I'm taking a risk. You know, I have money on the table right now and I'm taking a risk. And I want to win. You know, poker players tend to be competitive. They want to win those hands. But it's absolutely fascinating game, and one that, you know, I both my daughters play. It was very important to me that they would know how to play, particularly in college. You know, there's nothing better than a young woman being able to sit down the dorm room poker table and take all the chips.
Yeah. So I'm assuming you stepped away from your role as president, and I'm assuming the program is still being utilized throughout. Is it national or global?
It's actually global. When I left, we had 260 corporate partners across the globe. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. That's super. So now you recently joined a new organization, Cultivate Advisors, and you work with CEOs of small to mid-size businesses. Yes. And tell me about that, how the opportunity came to be and what you're most excited about.
Yeah, I am thrilled to be at Cultivate. I look at it as really the culmination of all the things that I have done throughout my career. I love to help. I love to see things grow and change and build. And I really like being at the heart of a business. And for me, the heart of the business is the financials. You have to hire really good people. You have to have a great product or service that you're selling. But you're going to make it or break it when you're a small company based off of your cash flows and your financial outlooks. And so Cultivate has this really sweet spot of working with private companies with revenues of about 1 to 2 million all the way up to 20 million. That's a really interesting inflection point in a small company's life of whether they're going to survive, you know, when you're in that 1 or 2 million range, or when you're getting, you know, to 10 to 20, are you going to be able to scale? Can you enter new markets? You know, so it's for me exactly what I love, because I love startups and I love the chaos of a startup and I love the figuring out of a startup. And so now I get to partner with the CEO and really be his or her business advisor as they're going through the process of building the company. Cultivate provides some really fantastic, you know, proprietary tools, software, frameworks in how we as advisors work with those CEOs on a very long-term, you know, relationship basis to scale the enterprise value.
Are you able to do that virtually, or do you have to travel?
No, not much travel at all, which is lovely.
Good.
Yeah,
travel in today's world can be completely unpredictable.
Yeah. Well, and I think now that so many of us are comfortable, you know, with all of our digital tools, there's a lot of unnecessary time spent, you know, wasted, in my opinion, commuting. You know, we shouldn't have to do that when we really can suffice quite well talking to each other across the screen.
Yeah. My last question, you know, when you look back over your life story, your personal life story and your career, what would you say has been the greatest lesson for you that you would share with our viewers about kind of the twists and turns that your life has taken? It's rarely a direct line.
No. And mine's a scatter plot for sure. I wanted it to be upward sloping to the right, but my life has been a scatter plot in the best ways. I've had a dot in every quadrant. So I'm a big follower of the Stoics and the teachings of the Stoics. And I use something that Epictetus has said, and I won't get, of course, the quote quite right, but it was something to do with, you know, how long are you going to wait before you demand the best for yourself? And I think moms in particular get this more than anybody, is how long are you going to wait? Because so often we backseat our lives, we backseat to our children, to our families, to our careers. And when do we actually demand the very best for ourselves? And I'm at that point in my life, is I am only saying yes to things that are really, really aligned with my values, aligned with my ambition, and aligned with getting me the very best, you know, out of my personal and professional life. And I don't think without all the scatter plots and all the bumps along the way that I would have the confidence to be where I am today, to demand that. And I took a long time after Poker Power to decide where I wanted to go next. I actually went to this most magical island off the coast of Morocco called Madeira, and I hiked and I wrote and I thought, and I really healed. You know, I healed my heart, I healed my mind. And I was ready to come back and tackle, you know, this next big challenge, because I love to be cognitively challenged. And that's what I was missing, is I've got to turn the brain on again. And this opportunity at Cultivate is exactly that.
It's great advice, really good advice. And of course, you allow yourself to have the mistakes, the failures, whatever word we want to use. It's really just, you know, finding out what's not working and pivoting to something else.
Absolutely. You have to. Just leave it. You know, and that's another thing that the Stoics say, it is Epictetus again, is it's control the controllable. Control the controllable and let everything else go. It's so hard to do that. But once you start introducing that as part of your guiding principles in your life, decision-making gets really simple. And so that's another one that I stand by.
Can I ask you, you mentioned in your talking about going away to the island, and you mentioned healing. Was there something in particular you needed to heal from?
I think I needed to spend time with myself again. I had spent, you know, over 5 years directly in startups, 24/7. And I had lost a lot of myself and, you know, the type of person I want to show up for my children and for my family. You know, my mother is, she's 80. She's the most wonderful woman in the world. And I've been going home a lot because my dad has dementia. So I've been flying home to Maine almost every month to spend time with him. Oh, I know. It's the reality for so many of us. You know, we have the younger children, the older parents.
Yes.
Hold it all together. Control the controllable. Right. I cannot control the dementia. But my mom, my mom said on one of my recent visits, she said, "Erin, you're back." And that really hit me. Because this is a woman who's known me from birth, of course. And she saw her daughter again. She saw this very calm, this very compassionate, this very centered. Like I think of myself now as a very centered, directed person. And I had lost that. And so I'm very careful. Like I'm trying to stay very present to that so I don't get lost and need to heal again. And if I do, I'll do it. Yeah, I know I can.
Yeah. That's so beautiful that your mom recognized that.
I know.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that. And thank you so much for taking time to be on the show and share some very good life lessons and a little bit about your story.
You're welcome. I enjoyed this. Thank you, Susan.
Stay with us as I go into the last break, and I'll be back to close out the show.
Hi, I'm Dawn Zier, CEO, board director, and executive mentor to Fortune 500 companies through my work at the EXCO Group, a firm of experienced CEOs, board directors, and global business leaders who offer real-world experience to help organizations and senior executives grow. Today, I'd like to speak about how to deal with a toxic work environment. While there are some well-documented cases of blatantly toxic cultures, toxicity in the workplace is often a more subtle nature, which can even be more dangerous to one's mental health and well-being. So how can one deal with a toxic relationship? While the path of least resistance may be avoidance, this isn't the healthiest of approaches, as odds are the negative behavior is often not just towards one person, but anyone that the person may perceive as a threat. As difficult as it may be, I encourage having a direct conversation. Plan and rehearse what you want to say. Be sure to stay diplomatic, but stand strong and be sure to address your concerns in a clear and concise manner. And in return, be ready to listen to what the other person has to say. Remember, no one has the right to make you feel uncomfortable in the workplace. Have another person moderate the conversation if needed. Also, escalate if there's no resolution. Looking back, perhaps the biggest mistake I made early on in my career as a new leader was tolerating poor behavior from one individual because I thought he was so smart and so invaluable to the company. What I failed to recognize was the mental and productivity impact that his behavior was having on the team as a whole. I didn't fire him, although the next manager did. Please follow me on LinkedIn at Dawn Zier. And if you're a senior executive looking to grow in your career, visit excoleadership.com to learn more.
Over on our Women to Watch YouTube channel, we have a partner profile series featuring some of the amazing executive women working at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Our latest installment features Dr. Susan Firth. Here's an excerpt from our latest conversation. The goal, I would say, of CHOP is for every child to have a chance at a healthy future. And how does the Research Institute specifically support and help in that goal?
One of our strategic imperatives as an enterprise is to really promote research-driven precision medicine, you know, so diagnostics and therapeutics that are really tailored to an individual's circumstance. And I always add to that research-driven precision medicine that this has to be research-driven precision medicine for everyone. So we've incorporated, we've invested in programs around health equity research methods and making sure that as we are pursuing our research and discovery, that we're thinking about how our questions apply to different populations, whether it's where they live, if they're rural or urban, or what their social determinants of health are. So we're trying to incorporate thinking broadly about improving child health to all populations. So we want to help children who are around the world and also in our backyard.
To learn more about Dr. Susan Firth, head over to our Women to Watch YouTube channel for the full interview.
We are CHOP, and we can't wait to show you around. We're the nation's first children's hospital. Now, a care network with more than 50 locations that continues to expand. 3 state-of-the-art research buildings with 1.5 million square feet of space. We have grown from 12 beds 165 years ago to nearly 600 beds and one of the best children's hospitals in the world. We have a level 1 trauma center, 11 floors of patient units, more than 20 operating rooms, first-of-its-kind delivery unit for babies with birth defects, a separate cardiac operative and catheterization suite, and places to learn, like our internationally recognized simulation center. We have trained generations of leaders in the field of pediatrics. We are world leaders in medicine, surgery, and science. One of the top recipients in NIH funding for pediatric research. In this building, pioneers in CAR T therapy, mitochondrial disease, brain tumors, hyperinsulinism, and other rare diseases. Here, groundbreaking work in fetal surgery, genetics and genomics, and neurology. In our newest building, leaders in social determinants of health, clinical informatics and epidemiology, autism, trauma and injury prevention. Our patients come from every state and 115 countries. Meeting these challenges requires the best and the brightest. We are passionate about pediatrics. We are motivated to make a difference in the world and in our community. We are a team. We are CHOP.
That's it for another week of Women to Watch. You may have seen our most recent April newsletter where I shared our current challenge, finding new sponsors for the show. In light of this, I'm going to be taking a pause in May to connect with some new corporate partners. And if you're interested in learning about what a sponsorship of Women to Watch looks like, I encourage you to reach out to me at susan@womentowatch.net. Please continue to follow me on LinkedIn. I'll be posting updates around the show, and I hope you'll stay in touch and stay inspired.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
Lowe's knows you take pride in every project. So take on what's next today with a free select Craftsman hedge trimmer or leaf blower when you buy a 20-volt push mower. That's a $119 value on reliable, high-performance Craftsman tools you trust.
For the power to do it all, build, repair, restore, maintain, go with Craftsman, available at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 5/21, while supplies last, selection varies by location.